in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is September 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KPU-sponsored event may be found at kpu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Stay tuned for Art Focus with host Ava Lake. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, where adult students of all ages can earn college credit towards a bachelor's degree for knowledge gained outside the classroom with community service, seminars, and on-the-job training, and more. Listeners can learn more about the information session on Wednesday, September 19th at 6:30 p.m. Details at merrillhurst.edu. And by Oregon College of Art and Crafts Studio School, offering classes and workshops for adults in book arts, ceramics, drawing and painting, fibers, metals, photography, and wood. www.ocac.edu/register.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Ava Lake. And thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. Today, I have with me Terry Hopkins, who is the curator of the Merrill Hurst Art Gym. And by the way, disclosure and disclaimer that it's so nice that Merrill Hurst is helping with this show, but this interview has nothing to do with that, really. It's just a kind of a fun coincidence. Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So we've got news, which has already spread like wildfire, but two things that you, after, 33 years?
Yes.
33 years are stepping down as the curator of the Merrill Hurst Art Gym, and also that a full-time curatorial position has been funded by the Eichholz Foundation.
That's right.
That's right. So Merrill Hurst Art Gym, you kind of were an instigator. It's an institution to us now, if you've only been here, let's say, 15 years or so. But you were sort of an instigator of that whole place coming about, right?
Right. There were three of us who started it. It was a gym. It was filled with old chairs and stuff. And the three of us were Kay Slasarenko, who was the chair of the art department at Merrill Hurst at the time, and sort of a snoop. And she had snooped around campus and saw this great, beautiful space that was unused. It had been a gymnasium auditorium. It had a stage at one end, but Merrill Hurst was in transition, and she thought that would make a great art gallery. Mm-hmm. And she was able to do the politics to get it.
Yes.
And then Paul Sutton, who's the chair now, and myself, we founded it. And I was the initial curator, and I've been the curator forever.
Ever since. But what were you doing at the time? Were you an instructor there at Merrill Hurst?
I was Kay's assistant, so I was assistant to the chair of the art department, and we did things like start up a BA in craft with Oregon College of Art and Craft before they went off on their own and were accredited fully.
Yes.
We launched eventually the Master's in Art Therapy and BFA in Interior Design, things like that. She did a lot of that with Paul after I became my job just became doing the art gym. But prior to doing the art gym, I worked with her for 2 years to kind of get the department on track.
And so let's just talk a little bit in general terms what the art gym does. From what I understand, it is a place for artists in the Pacific Northwest to show.
That's right. So we started out and, you know, we had this gorgeous space. For those people who've been around a long time, PCVA, Portland Center for the Visual Arts, was still going. It's kind of the predecessor to PICA.
Yes.
The Northwest Artists Workshop was going. Blue Sky was going. And we felt that the museum always has had a broad mandate, but they weren't doing a lot at that point in time with contemporary art of this region. And we thought that was something we could do with our big space. And we also decided to do publications from the beginning. And so our idea was to show contemporary art in this region, publish about it, and host
public conversation. Mm-hmm. So our mission was to expand public understanding of the art of this region. And it was also our mission to treat it seriously. And part of that was became the publications.
Yes.
Because the publications endure, and as everyone knows, an exhibition lasts 1, 2, 3 months, mm-hmm. and then it's gone. And we also eventually, we can't do a publication for every show, but we tend to do maybe one larger publication and one smaller publication per year. Mm-hmm. But we also write about every show. We do a very low production value newspaper that we send out for each show, and I write about all the shows. So there's always a piece of writing, and then that ends up now, of course, on the webpage. And actually, all of our publications are available online as downloadable PDFs. So that's about 70 publications since 1980.
And that's a really great document, wouldn't you say? Because, well, like you said, the exhibitions, they come and they go. But these documents are a record of what happened here in Portland, Oregon. Did you find that before that time, it was just sort of assumed this was a backwater when actually there was some great art happening? People just didn't, there wasn't access to it, you might say?
PCVA was founded to bring art to Portland that had a national reputation, artists who had a national reputation. And so I think the people that founded that, Mike Russo, Mel Katz, and Jay Backstrand, perhaps felt it was a backwater, and they really needed the influx of that national conversation, and they want to be a part of that national conversation. And so artists, including Paul, for example, took in every single show and volunteered at PCVA, helped work and install pieces. So I think the artists made a conscious effort to connect with the national conversation starting in the 70s. And I see that as still going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another matter, perhaps, to have work by artists who are based in a particular region treated with any kind of intellectual seriousness. Like, we should take this seriously because this is very good work.
And, that's right.
And there are things to write about it and how it relates to a national conversation. Sometimes I think about Italy, and you can like throw a stone and be in another major art center if you're in the Renaissance. I mean, Siena, Florence, Rome.
Yes.
So, Venice.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know why in such a huge country these nodes of creativity that I think there are many more than even I am aware of.
Mm-hmm.
We just tend to know what's going on where you live and perhaps what's going on in New York and L.A., but not perhaps what's going on in Atlanta or what's going on in Birmingham or what's going on in Chicago.
Yes. So the Merrillhurst Art Gym helped document that and bring it. So your position was not necessarily endowed, or how did that all come about, and how did you end up getting this great endowment? we should give a little credence to what's actually going on right now.
Yeah, well, my position has always been a faculty position in the art department.
Mm-hmm.
So the art department has paid my salary all these years, such as it is.
Yeah,
and I went from half time to 0.6.
Whoa.
At some point. I also did some teaching until about the last 3 years. I taught professional practices. But I turned that over about 3 years ago to Brendan Clenigan, who's one of our painting instructors, because I needed to focus on this transition. So even though everybody's finding out about it now, I've been trying to prepare for this transition for about 5 years. And that included renovating the gallery, which I believe you've seen.
Yes.
And I think it's
beautiful.
It's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it's everything I hoped and dreamed. And it functions incredibly, which our next show opens October 6th for Fernanda D'Agostino. And the whole gallery is completely transformed into almost a dream state.
Cool.
All the shades are down. The light level's low. There's about 1, 2, 3, 4 projected videos. The space is divided up in a maze-like space that mm-hmm. you kind of wander as if you're wandering through somebody's brain. Mm-hmm. That would be Nanda's brain.
Right.
So, you know, we had a great David Eckert show. It was completely different from that. M.K. Guth, completely different for that. So that's the dream that I had, that the we could create a system.
Good flexibility.
Yeah.
Things could be moved around.
That the gallery could serve the art.
Yes.
And adapt. So that happened with the help of the Collins Foundation and the Ford Family Foundation and some individuals. And then my other goal had been that when I left, my position could be full-time. I wanted it to be a good job for the next person because I wanted really great people to want the job.
Yes, yes.
And
well, I think there are some who do.
I think there's some really great people who want the job,
yes.
Which is very exciting to me.
Uh-huh.
How it came about was interesting. I kind of didn't think it was going to happen.
The money?
Yeah, for the position.
Uh-huh.
You know, we had some inquiries out there, but we weren't getting too far. And then, I don't know how to describe it, kind of a miracle happened.
Yes. It came out of the sky, sailed down to you.
It did. It did. But
somebody had to have been watching you, what you guys were doing all this time.
And that person has a name.
Okay.
And his name is Michael Davidson, and Michael has A&E Tax Services, and he does a lot of tax work with artists and writers and performers. And I used to, for probably 10 or 15 years, he came to my professional practices class to talk about small business stuff for artists and doing your taxes and your record keeping properly.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 3 hours a year.
Whoa.
But as it turned out, about 2 years ago, Michael's family founded the Robert and Mercedes Eichholz Foundation, unbeknownst to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they did fund Bruce Gunther's position at the Portland Art Museum about 2 years ago.
Very good.
But I wasn't paying attention.
Yes. Uh-oh.
But... I got a call from Michael, and we got together, and he asked how the art gym was doing, and I explained I was working on this transition, and the renovation was going well, but I was hoping for an endowment, and,
right.
And he said, how much would that cost?
Nice.
Good question.
Yes.
So they wanted to get that going, and so they're giving us, in January, they will write us a check for $250,000 to sort of carry it. We don't have to match that. And then each year for 4 years, Merrillhurst will need to meet the challenge of $250,000 a year. So eventually the endowment will be $2.25 million to fund the position.
Very good.
Yeah. So very exciting to me.
Yes.
To see that happen.
So I remember the first time I met you, I had a little space called Love Lake. It was just a little exhibition space in Northwest Portland. And you were there, I believe it was for Dee Reich's show.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember...
I remember that.
Do you remember it?
Yeah.
That's the first time I met you.
Yeah.
And Dee Reich, incredible artist, by the way, who went to Merrillhurst.
Right.
And...
I tend to go to my... alumni shows.
It's good to be loyal. It truly is.
Well, you know, they're starting out, especially first shows.
Yes. And I remember you saying that, we had a short conversation just about curating, and mm-hmm. I remember you saying that you had had a space before, you had done some kind of project before, and it didn't last that long and it didn't need to. It seems to me like you even said it was 6 or 7 months, but I could be wrong.
Purple Daggers.
So talk to me a little bit about that, because I actually have to also defend Closing Love Lake, you know, that things don't last forever. They're mm-hmm. projects. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about this project.
Purple Daggers was a planned obsolescence gallery.
Yeah.
It lasted for 4 months.
Oh, it was founded
by six artists,
mm-hmm.
and we did 3 two-person shows. The gallery was upstairs in part of somebody's studio on Southwest Yamhill.
Mm-hmm.
We did 3 two-person shows and an invitational outdoor sculpture exhibition in Waterfront Park.
Cool.
Yeah. And I was the so-called business manager, and I was paid $25 a month.
There you go.
So, and which I bought so was a $25 print with.
Was this like around 1980 or was it in the
70s? Mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Mid-70s.
Yes. And have you done any other sort of, you know, rock and roll independent projects like that before you took on Merrill Hurst? I'm just trying to get an idea, like, what prepared you for the position?
What prepared me for the position was that I studied art history at Oberlin College and went on for a master's degree at the University of Chicago. And my life plan was to become an art history professor.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for one term at a community college and hated it.
Now tell us why.
I didn't like standing up there talking about art history. I like looking at art. I like thinking about art. I like reading about art. Uh-huh. But it was a really big surprise to me that I wouldn't want to do that. So then I had to figure out what to do, having spent about 7 years of my life in dark rooms looking at slides projected on a wall.
Right.
And I also realized I knew nothing about how the art community worked, which is why I wanted to teach professional practices to the Merrill Hurst students.
Uh-huh.
So I went about trying to figure that out. And so I tried different things, none of which I liked.
Well, I just have one question to interject here.
Yeah.
So was it also possible that you were meant to be around living artists as opposed, you know, like having a conversation about what's happening right now as opposed to talking about what happened, I mean, even 200 years ago or 500 years ago?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it was. But I didn't know that because I didn't know very many living artists until I moved to Portland.
Uh-huh.
At Oberlin, it was different because the art history studios and the studios were in the same building. And so art was always there, mm-hmm. and the artists were always there. At the University of Chicago, the art history was in the quad, and the studio buildings were across the midway on mm-hmm. the ghetto, right?
Yes.
And so there seemed to be no conversation going on between the art historians and the artists there. And that was different. When I moved to Portland, I almost immediately met artists. I actually worked in a commercial gallery called Arthur Erickson Eclectic Arts, and I met Hank Pander, for example. He was one of the first artists I met. And then I helped lobby for the Percent for Art laws in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And through that process, I started to meet artists. But in the process of doing that, I just started hanging out more with artists. And Purple Daggers was sort of more of an intro
crossover
to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also tried to do things in the community, like Community Arts Administration. I worked down in Albany for about 2 years. But I wasn't a good fit for that. So basically, I was... not suited to be an art historian in academia, but I was also not suited to living in the real world. And so I needed to get back
hanging out with artists is this place in between.
I needed to be in academia. And I eventually, it took me maybe 5 or 6 years to figure that out. But I also knew I needed to be in academia where it intersected with the community.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Ava Lake, and this is Art Focus. If you want more information about this radio show, you can go to kboo.fm/artfocus, and you can see links to my guests, information about my guests. I have with me today Terry Hopkins. She's the curator at the Merrill Hurst Art Gem. She is going to be leaving at the beginning of next year, yes?
Yes.
Yes, after 33 years curating this this institution, this gallery space. And you also wrote the catalogs. I mean, to me, that seems like a huge amount of work. Were you writing a lot about art before then? Because whenever I write at all about art, it is a...
painful.
Well, it is. It's tough.
Yeah, it's painful. I didn't write them all, thank God. I wrote some of them. But with each publication, I tried to create the publication that the artist wanted. I built a program that I think is what I would call artist-centric.
Mm-hmm.
It's about paying attention to the artists, nurturing their careers, trying to provide opportunity and act as a catalyst for new work or look at past work. So when we did the publications, I would actually ask them who they would want to write for their publication. And so as a result, we have all kinds of writers that have written for us. I mean, just all kinds of people. Randy Gregg wrote a great essay for David Eckerd early on. My colleagues at Reed and Lewis and Clark, Stephanie Snyder and Linda Tessner have and are writing. Linda wrote the essay for Fernando D'Agostino's book, The Method of Loci, and that's coming out, you know, soon. And Stephanie's writing an essay for one of the next shows for Heather Watkins. But We've had people like John Raymond, who wrote for Melody Owen, and he's also going to be writing for Vanessa Renwick this spring.
Yes, she's going to have an exhibition that's kind of a little retrospective, sort of, or is it a special project?
It's a special project.
Okay.
Nanda's is a retrospective, unconventional, I'm calling it. But both of them use projected video and sort of sculptural experiences. Mm-hmm. Vanessa is going to transform the art gym. She's going to, whereas Nanda's show is dark, Vanessa's pushing all those walls, 12 walls, all the one end of the gallery to open it wide open. All the windows will be revealed. She's going to fix colored gels on all the multiple panes of those windows, which to her look like sort of giant iconic birds.
Nice.
And there'll be different birds. And then in the center, there'll be installations where the video's projected down onto screens and you lie on the floor and look up, which, as you know, is something that she likes to do. But in this case, there'll be birds that you're watching in the sky.
Wow. Well, I remember the one film that's got the raven in it. Do you know what I'm talking about? The head of that bird?
Yeah.
Yes.
So she's very interested in birds.
Yes. Well, I'm sure I'm going to like that show then.
Yeah.
So these are just kind of some maybe more general questions about curating or what have you. But was there a show that was particularly challenging for you as a curator? Or what are the challenging parts of it? I can imagine it started out sort of simple and became more and more complex over the years.
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's always complex.
Yeah.
I think the challenge of being a curator is the challenge of paying attention. And so when you're starting out, there's all kinds of stuff that you want to show, and there's no time in the world, you know, that you're going to be able to do that. So I just tried to slow myself down and say, I'll do one thing at a time, you know, one foot in front of the other. But I think you need many curators in a community because people have different points of view, and a good exhibition program has a curatorial voice.
Yes.
And so, and academic curators are a little bit different. You know, and so if you look at our strong academic galleries, Reed, Lewis and Clark, Merrill Hurst, Willamette University, for example.
Yes.
They have curators and directors, and those people have a point of view.
Yes, we want that.
We want that.
Yes.
Right. And so, in my opinion, we need a lot more of that.
Points of view.
A lot more points of view. Just like, you know, as you know, there's kind of a dearth of writing about art.
Boy, I'll say.
And we could use 20 writers.
We could. It seems to be that we had sort of this interesting crescendo and then it all went away. Like, I just remember when I first came here, the first few years, I thought there were, when I came back was 97. And it just seemed like, even though there was just a few, then like the internet kind of broke wide open and there seemed to be a lot. I'm not saying it was all good, but there seemed to be more. But now it's gone back, it's gone full circle and it's back to, there's not enough writing. There's stuff going on, but it's definitely not being written about.
And I think, you know, it's partly a problem that how do you make a living?
Yes.
Right? And so making a living as an artist or a writer, and especially now that the newspapers are disappearing, how are people going to get paid to write?
If you can solve that one.
Yeah. You know, so maybe you're right out of graduate school and you've got a couple years that you can, like, give away. But after that, what happens?
What happens?
So I think that is a huge issue, but I think it's also makes it, I think, a critical, timely response to things. That voice, the journalist's voice, the art critic's voice is very important, but the fact that that's disappearing to some degree, I think is still very important for these publications, small, large, even very small-scale publications, to invite people to write about art. And that's something a program like Merrill Hurst has done and can continue to do.
So what we know that as we're talking right now, there's people out there applying for this gig.
Yes.
So do you have any aspirations for them, thoughts for them, advice for them? Or, I mean, I guess I'm just thinking, like, what would you like to see, and what do you think they should be thinking about?
I'd like to see somebody who has some experience curating shows. I'm not looking for me in 1980.
Right.
Somebody who didn't know anything.
Yes. Hey, you've built this thing. You want it to, yeah. You want it to,
you know,
go from
maybe me 20 years ago or 10 years ago or something.
But
know?
Not 33 years ago.
No. Yeah. Somebody ideally is just someone who has a point of view, who's energetic, who's really excited about staging exhibitions. My preference would be somebody who is really artist-centered, who is willing to take a look at what's going on. You know, the art gym is kind of grassroots in its own way, even though it's been there forever.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
By that I mean,
it's local.
You're not looking for name brands. You're trying to find out who's working and who just got here. And, you know, I think someone who has some excitement about that, who's, you know, curiosity is a really good trait to have as a curator.
I like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're very closed down.
Yeah, just sort of get out and go look at stuff. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'm hoping it's somebody who is aware of stuff that's going on in this town that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great. It could be somebody from the outside who lands here and starts poking their nose in.
Mm-hmm.
To where things are. I mean, there's a few people have heard of Purple Daggers,
yes.
You know, but, you know, that was a 4-month window.
Yes.
Right? And I'm sure there's stuff going on now that appears and disappears that's very important.
Well, I've thought actually a lot about that particular thing. I just remember maybe it was a year or so ago, I went to a show at Nacional. And at this show, really great painters, and two of the painters I had shown at Lovelake like 10 years before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I kind of thought, like, we have this bottom here. I mean, let's just think of the art world as a triangle. And at the top is maybe the Portland Art Museum. But then there's the art gym and that. And then there's, like, and then there's Elizabeth Leach. And then there's, like, but there's not a lot of middle ground. And there's not, and even all of that that's on top is very narrow, right?
Yeah.
What I see Portland is often being held up by the Nacionales, you know, or I'm just saying these mm-hmm. new
It's
upstarts.
A foundation.
Yes.
There's a broad foundation. The most important thing, if we're going to have artists, that artists can live here.
Yes.
And make work. And that's tough. And so people like the Ford Family Foundation, when they have the fellowships, when they bring curators and
yes.
to town to talk to artists and maybe expand their vision of where their work might fit into a national conversation or who else they might want to talk to, for example, or Ford also supports publications and exhibitions, those kind of things, the Bonnie Bronson Fellowships, you know, those happen here and there. RAC, Work for Art Program, being in the millions of dollars now, that is such a good sign.
Yes, it is.
And so I really see the foundation not as the galleries, but the artists.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, it's all interrelated, Ava, but it's the artists. We have to have the artists, you know, and the artists make things happen and they mm-hmm. make the art. There's not any art. There's no culture without artists. And so building a culture that fosters that, we haven't done the greatest job, but we've mm-hmm. improved.
We've improved. And, well, everybody's caught on, too, because there's people coming from all over the world to live here because it is affordable, mm-hmm. I think, amongst other things. One thing that you're going to have coming up, but I want to mention it before we're done today, a movable conversation.
Yes.
On October 20th.
Right.
So this is an example of a panel discussion that mm-hmm. the Art Gym puts on. Tell us about this event.
Well, Christy Edmonds, who was the founder of PICA and now works for an organization in California, is close friends with Nanda D'Agostino and Stephen Hayes, and mm-hmm. they both have major exhibitions this fall. In fact, Stephen's show opens tomorrow at Lewis and Clark.
Very good.
Or is it tonight? Tonight.
It's very soon. It's tonight.
I think it's tonight, 5 okay. to 7.
All right.
The Hoffman Gallery, and that's a 30-year retrospective for Stephen Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
And Nanda's show opens October 6th. So mm-hmm. That conversation is about sustaining a long career in the visual arts, an exciting career, and it's also about their work. So it'll start at Merrillhurst at 2 and continue at Lewis and Clark at 3:30 on that day, and it's free.
Great.
People should come.
Thank you. Yes. So, Terry, thanks so much for joining us here at Art
You're
Focus.
Welcome.
I've got to wrap this up. That was Terry Hopkins. She's stepping down at the beginning of next year as the director, curator of the Merrillhurst Art Gym. Wanted to let you know I'll be back in 2 weeks, and I'm going to have James Gallagher as my guest. He is a curator and artist based in New York City, and he has a new magazine collage-based work that's coming out. My name's Ava Lake, and thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. I'll be talking with you in a couple weeks.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
And I have an important announcement. There will be a peace vigil in Portland tomorrow. Stand for Peace, Wednesday, September 11th, 6 p.m. on the Hawthorne Bridge. Bring a candle or a sign.
You're listening to KBOO, Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
Triangle Productions and KBOO Community Radio are proud to present Kiss of the Spider Woman. The Oregon premiere of this 7-time Tony Award-winning musical will be at The Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The show will run from September 5th through the 29th. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Radio, in association with Radio Lost and Founds and the Media Net Web, present a film this coming Thursday, September 12th, at Portland's historical Clinton Street Theater.